Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:03 p.m. and it is Wednesday, March 30th, 2022. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Talia Ames from the Juneau LAO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, right now, we have Representative Vance. Representative Snyder is here on Teams. Myself, Representative Clayman. I don't see anyone else on Teams. Oh, Representative Kirk is also here on Teams. And that actually means we'll have a quorum to conduct business. I want to note, we sent an email out earlier. I have a bill scheduled for consideration in another committee. And when that bill is about to be called, we're going to recess to the call of the chair, but I don't know when that's going to happen. And Representative Drummond has also joined us. Our first order of business today is the confirmation hearing on the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. The Speaker referred the following appointment made by Chief Justice Winfrey to the Judiciary Committee, H. Connor Thomas, to the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. Members have received a resume for the appointee. The appointee is online and will testify. We will now open for public testimony. Mr. Thomas, because you're on the phone, please make sure you are not on a speakerphone, as the sound quality is not as clear and it is often difficult to hear what you're saying. And if you want to then go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I was on speakerphone and picked it up. So at any rate, thank you, Chairman Clayman. As indicated, I am a nominee for another term on the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics by way of personal history, which I assume you have on the resume there, but I'll go over briefly. I'm a 44-year resident of Nome, Alaska. I am an attorney by occupation. During my time in Nome, I've worked in various positions, Alaska Legal Services, Alaska Public Defender, served for a short time as a magistrate in a local court, and have been in private practice since 1986. I am currently doing that, although I am working part-time, so a lot less than I have in the past. I have a fairly lengthy history with the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics, first appointed in 1998. I was interested in the committee because I feel like that Alaska's been very good to me, and it seemed like a small way to express some gratitude by volunteering some time for something that I happen to believe in, which is ethics. And I think that the Alaska public supports the mission of the Ethics Committee, and in addition, the Ethics Committee provides a service to legislators or those subject to the Ethics Act, specifically with what we call the Ethics Committee a heads-up policy, which I assume a number of you have used, where if you have a question, you can call our administrator, in this case, Jerry Anderson, with a question. So I have more time than I've had in the past, and desire to serve another term if confirmed. So that's my short history of myself and my time on the committee, and I'm certainly willing to try and answer any questions if anybody has any. So thank you.
So recognize that Representative Eastman joined us at about 1:07 p.m. I have only one question because you answered my frequent question. Is this your first term? Obviously not. How long is the term?
3 years.
Okay. Questions from members of the committee? Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Thomas, for putting yourself out there. I'm a little unclear. You were first appointed in 1998 and served 3 years. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And you're not currently serving. This is not a reappointment to...
No, I am currently serving. It is a reappointment. I'm sorry if that was not clear.
Oh, okay. So 1998 were your first 3 years, and you're in the process, and you're ending your second 3 years, yeah. And you're being reappointed to an additional...
No, it's been consecutive. So
the short answer is that he has been appointed by more governors, and I'm going to try to recount.
Thank you. I'm sorry, that's not clear from the resume that I have in front of me.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Eastman.
Actually, for clarity, that actually he's not been appointed by any governors. The governor doesn't make that appointment. It's the courts that make that appointment through the Chief Justice.
And Representative Eastman, you are 100% correct.
Thank you.
I apologize for my misspeaking.
Through the chair, I'm curious, how is the committee doing as far as recruiting members? I know obviously some like yourself have been on for decades. When I sat on the committee, they were having trouble filling some of the open spots. How are they doing these days?
I would say the answer to that is still the same. You may know, there are two alternates that are on the committee. The committee's had some trouble finding people that are willing to serve. The administrator has advertised for people, we have had some interest, in short answer to your question, I would say that there's not been a great interest among a large number of people for service on the committee.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Thomas? Rep. Snyder.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, go ahead, Rep. Snyder.
Thank you. To follow up on that question from Representative Eastman, could you speak a little bit to why you think that those difficulties may persist? I don't have a good appreciation of the workload associated with this committee or other challenges that might make recruitment difficult. Could you speak to that a little bit, please?
Well, I could try. And the short answer to your question, I don't really know, because from where I sit, service on the committee in terms of volunteer activity is ideal, because generally the workload is not so significant that it gets in the way of your other occupation, assuming that you've got one. I do not know the answer to your question about why more people might not be interested in service on the committee, because I don't think it's so burdensome. The subject matter can be sometimes thorny and sometimes acrimonious, but it's not constant in terms of the work that we do. So I don't know. I'm at a loss to understand why more people might not be interested.
Follow up, Representative Snyder?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Kirk, any questions? Doesn't look like it. Okay, I don't see any other questions. And do we have anyone online? Is there anyone in the room that wants to provide testimony on H. Connor Thomas's nomination to the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics? Hearing and seeing no one, we're going to close public testimony. And that gets us to final comments. And I think first round on this one is Representative Vance. Any comments? Not required.
None at this time, thank you.
All right, Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I guess I'm just have the same types of questions that Representative Snyder had. Let's dig into maybe why it is that the committee is not more successful. I think we can kind of look at them as really not part of the legislature, but they are part of the legislative branch, and I think it's our responsibility to help them out if they're having recruitment difficulties.
Representative Kirka, any comments about the nominee? Is Representative Christ-Tompkins on the phone with us? Representative Christ-Tompkins, I apologize, I was looking for you on Teams. Did you have any questions for Mr. Thomas, or did you have any comments about his application?
No questions, Mr. Chair, but extraordinary gratitude for his 10-year service on what's not a low stakes committee, and I think requires a high caliber of individual to serve on or serve well, and it seems like he's done that over the years, so I just want to offer my thanks.
Rep. Snyder.
Just echoing those words of thanks for your continued service.
Rep. Drummond.
Yeah, I want to echo what others have said, and thank you for your long, continuous service. If I'm doing the math right, it's on the order of 33 years. So thank you very much, sir, for your commitment to the work of the committee.
And as chair, I'll just also appreciate, now this is my eighth year in the legislature, and I've seen him a couple of previous times, and he's just very dedicated to the work, and I think it's a reflection of the importance of the work. And I also agree with, if we're having recruitment difficulties, we should certainly look for ways to try to make that better. Having completed our comments, Representative Snyder.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. In accordance with AS24.60.130, the Judiciary Committee has reviewed the qualifications of the following Chief Justice's appointee and recommends that the following name be forwarded to the House for ratification: H. Connor Thomas to the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. This does not reflect intent by any of the members to vote for or against this individual during any further sessions for the purposes of ratification.
The name will be forwarded to the House for ratification. Please be sure to sign the confirmation committee report. For those that are on Teams, if you want to come down and sign that, you're welcome to, but I don't think all signatures are necessarily required to move forward. Okay. That brings us to our second and final order of business today, which is House Bill 5, Sexual Assault, Definition of Consent, sponsored by Representative Tarr. This is the third hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Today we'll have available for invited testimony Renee McFarland, Deputy Public Defender from the Public Defender Agency, Department of Administration, and James Stinson, Director, Office of Public Advocacy, Department of Administration, about both agencies' perspective on House Bill 5. I think they're both on the record, and I don't think they either came with prepared testimony, but they're here to answer questions. I told them I would start with kind of an opening question, and then I'll get out of the way, and committee members can ask questions, and I may have others. But and I recognize that House Bill 5, there's a governor has a crime bill both in the Senate and the House. The Senate bill is 187, and so an opening topic would be, how does the change in the consent definition in House Bill 5, and for that matter, Senate Bill 187, affect sex crimes prosecution and defense compared to the current status or the current statute? And Ms. McFarland or Mr. Stinson, who wants to go first? Looks like we've got Ms. McFarland up first.
I'm happy to start. For the record, Renee McFarland with the Public Defender Agency. So under current law, sex assault prosecutions require the state to prove that the conduct at issue was without consent, but our statutes define without consent to mean something more than what people generally think of. And what that means is that a person with or without resisting is coerced by the use of force against a person or property, or by the express or implied threat of death, imminent physical injury, or kidnapping to be inflicted on anyone. And then there's another provision that talks about where a defendant causes a person to be incapacitated. And so force has a broad definition under Alaska law. It means any bodily impact or restraint. So the way, setting aside the incapacitation theory, we generally think of sexual assault under the current statute as conduct that is coerced through the use of force. Both HB 5 and SB 187 repeal this definition of without consent, and they both provide a definition that's more in line with how non-lawyers practicing sex assault prosecutions in Alaska think of consent, but they go about it a little differently. HB 5 eliminates the requirement of force altogether, and it looks to just affirmative consent. The use of force can show a lack of affirmative consent, but it's not necessary for the prosecution. SB 187, by contrast, creates a distinction between sexual conduct that is, done through force, that remains a higher level offense, and then there's a lower level offense where there is a lack of affirmative consent, but no force being involved. There's also some slight differences in the definition of the consent in both bills, between the two bills, and how the surrounding circumstances are going to be looked at. I'd say that HB 5 probably has more detail and more direction on those questions than SB 187 does. But both bills represent a pretty significant departure from the way sex assault prosecutions are currently handled in Alaska.
Mr. Stinson, any additional comments on the same topic?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Klayman. For the record, James Stinson, Director of the Office of Public Advocacy. To echo what Ms. McFarland said, it does seem that SB 187 is sort of maintaining more of the current statutory framework to make that distinction between still using force. And I believe in listening to the discussions on 187, that was something that the subcommittee really talked back and forth about the issues they felt with having sort of conduct that was without consent being treated the same as, you know, those more egregious situations of forcible rape involving a weapon. And so I think that might have been how they tried to figure out how to separate those as tiered offenses between an unclassified offense and a felony offense.
How will these affect, in your respective offices, how do you expect these to affect caseloads? Well, let's start with House Bill 5. That's the bill before us. How would you expect House Bill 5, if it passed in its current terms, how would that affect caseloads specific to the consent provisions?
Yes, thank you, Chair Klayman. There's been a lot of discussion since this bill was first heard, and there's been a lot of discussion around Senate Bill 187. After receiving information on fiscal notes anticipated from the Department of Law and what their take now is, after I think assessing it, that change to consent, both in HB 5 and SB 187, they're presumed to have the same impact. And that impact is that there's going to be a much broader range of conduct potentially captured. I think Department of Law has indicated that they're going to be charging more cases. The types of cases that they're going to be charging are anticipated by the defense to be probably more litigious cases, probably cases where there's going to be motion work, cases that are more likely to go to trial. So I think what we are anticipating is an increase, essentially, in caseloads and pretrial litigation and in trials as a result of either of these bills passing.
Ms. McFarland?
For the record, Renee McFarland, I agree. We also expect the caseloads to increase. I think what it does is it captures conduct that's not currently prosecuted. So in addition to the conduct that's currently being prosecuted, there's a whole other category of potential cases out there that now would be eligible for prosecution. And based on what the Department of Law has suggested, we anticipate a significant increase in caseloads. And because of the nature of the offenses, these are serious offenses that require experience and a lot of time, and the litigation is more intensive. So we think it will also increase, those cases will be cases that are more complex and more complicated and take more time to litigate.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you to the chair. And I'm also to ask you, maybe you don't have the answer to this, but can you speak to how Alaska's conception of sexual assault in statute compares to other states?
You mean in the bill or the current status?
I'm talking about the current statute right now, but then I'll ask about the bill maybe in a follow-up.
For the record, this is Renee McFarland. Through the chair, Representative Eastman. I can't speak in too much detail. I've only ever practiced in Alaska, so I don't actually know much about what other states do. I do know that what I can say is that our statute tracks to a certain extent the common law law of rape. There's a distinction in that resistance is not required, but the change that happened in 1978 when we adopted the current statutes, it did, it took away the requirement that a victim resist, which was one of the original common law ideas of rape. That's now gone. And but it still otherwise tracks common law, which I think is true for a lot of states. There are some states that have adopted affirmative consent provisions like those in the bill here. And if committee wants, I can give a little bit of detail about that. But again, it's hard to get a full understanding of exactly the details of how each state goes about these things. So I can give an overview, but I don't have a lot of detail.
Well, Representative Eastman.
And can you take a stab at quantifying, you know, what additional resources, you know, we should expect will be needed from your office in the event that this does become law? And obviously, there seems to be general agreement that there's going to be more cases, and some of those cases are going to be more litigious. But can you help us understand to what extent that will impact your office in terms of actual resources?
Sure. For the record, Renee McFarland, through the chair, Representative Eastman. So we have not submitted a fiscal note on HB 5. We have one, but it's indeterminate. We have, however, submitted a draft note for SB 187, and that, I think, is probably close to it. Probably is not exactly, because the bills do they overlap as to affirmative consent, but then they both address different issues. But the primary driver of our fiscal note, our draft note in 187, is the affirmative consent language. And what we're asking for in that is a total of 11 positions to be added to the agency. Six of those are staff positions, office assistants, paralegals, investigators, and then four lawyers, one for appeals and, or five lawyers, excuse me, one for appeals and four for our trial offices. We think that this is a conservative estimate. You know, this is such a change in how these cases are being prosecuted in Alaska. We don't actually know what the workload will look like just because it's never been done here. So we anticipate there being more, but we might be underestimating the amount of that. And one of the reasons for that is because these sex assault cases are generally assigned to our most experienced and efficient lawyers. They're serious cases with serious consequences, and so they go to our highest level lawyers. But those lawyers' efficiency and experience is with the statutory scheme we have right now, so they will lose some of that when trying to learn this whole new scheme. And if that adds into also an increase in prosecutions, we might be underestimating the need that we'll have. And so what we have put forth in our draft for 187 is our conservative estimate, as you can see, but you know, that's all prediction and we're not quite sure exactly what it'll look like.
Mr. Stinson, any further comment? I know there was a representative who had an earlier question about comparing with other states' laws, and you could, if you can provide your response both to that earlier question and the more recent one.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Klayman. Once again, James Stinson, Director of the Office of Public Advocacy. Just following up with what Ms. McFarland already said, I know of two states that I believe have affirmative consent statutes. I think Washington is one. I think Montana is another, but I don't have much more to add. I think there had been some testimony or discussion. I don't know if it was in the subcommittee on HB 5 before this one or if it was in 187. Where there was, I know there was at least a comment that because the changes in those states are so recent, there wasn't an enormous amount of data as to how that impacted prosecutions or defense yet. That's the only thing I recall, the only thing I have to add.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to either Mr. Stinson or Ms. McFarland, based upon the types of cases that you've seen, do you believe that with the passage of this bill that you would see more convictions and, from the victim's perspective, more successful prosecutions?
And we'll get them each to answer the questions rather than picking and choosing, so they can both answer the question. Mr. Stinson, why don't you go first this time?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Klayman. Once again, James Stinson, Director of Office of Public Advocacy. That's a difficult and interesting discussion. It's one I've been thinking about an awful lot, trying to have discussions with Department of Law and others. I think the thing that we can conclude is that there will be more cases charged. There will be more conduct charged. But as to the fundamental issues with prosecuting many of these types of cases, I don't see how those problems go away. I think that there's been a lot of potentially misinformed comments about some of the hopes surrounding this. I know there was one comment about how terrible it is that, you know, a victim has to be cross-examined about their lack of injury, for example, which I understand that that might be a terrible thing for somebody to go through. But changing this to an affirmative consent definition is not going to change that. That's still going to be relevant to whether or not there was affirmative consent. And so in a lot of respects, a lot of what you're going to see is still the same in terms of cross-examination, investigation, right? Issues with late reporting, issues with intoxication. And so it's hard to fully suss out all the scenarios where this would lead to a successful, not just a successful charge, but a successful prosecution and conviction. And then the interaction with the rape shield law is also a complicated one that's probably going to be litigated. So I wish I had a better answer, but I do think it will result in more initial charges.
Ms. McFarland.
For the record, Renee McFarland, through the chair, Representative Vance. I agree that I think what we can say for sure is that there will be more prosecutions. And I think we could also say that there are probably more cases that could go to trial as opposed to being dismissed at the indictment stage for not constituting an offense, especially with respect to second-degree assault prosecution, sexual contact as opposed to sexual penetration. Whether or not that will result in more convictions, I think, is something that none of us can really say one way or the other. That's, you know, what a jury is going to be considering in these cases is not just the victim's lack of affirmative consent, but whether the defendant was reckless to that. And they'll be looking at the totality of the circumstances. And so it'll be a case-by-case determination that every jury will make. And I don't know that we can say with any certainty what effect it will have on convictions, although we can when it comes to prosecutions.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, I'm sort of new to the Judiciary Committee, and I need to know, who does the Public Defender Agency defend? Ms. McFarland.
For the record, Renee McFarland, through the chair, Representative Drummond. The Alaska Public Defender Agency represents indigent Alaskans charged in the state of Alaska with a criminal offense, as well as individuals whose children are being subject to custody by the state, undergoing civil commitment, doing post-conviction litigation in the trial and appellate courts, and juveniles who are charged as delinquents. And for the first time this past couple of years, people who are subject to quarantine and isolation proceedings.
Mr. Stinson, can you provide a similar response with the Office of Public Advocacy?
Thank you, Chair Clayman. Once again, James Stinson, Director, Office of Public Advocacy. To answer that question, it's the same answer for the purposes of this conversation. We represent the same people in those types of proceedings. The Office of Public Advocacy also does many other things. We provide guardians ad litem to children and child in need of aid cases. We have an elder fraud section that's quasi-prosecutorial. But in terms of, I think, the relevance of your question, we essentially represent the same demographic that Ms. McFarland has spoken to.
Follow?
Yes. Who is defending the victims of sexual crimes?
Mr. Stinson, you get the first round on this one.
Sure. So through the chair, Representative, the Department of Law is who prosecutes those cases. So they are the state authority tasked with prosecuting individuals charged with those crimes. And then the Office of Victims' Rights also represents victims in those proceedings.
Okay.
Ms. McFarland, anything to add? No. Okay.
Okay. So
follow up?
My statement will be, it sounds like your two agencies are reluctant to improve safety in Alaska because it would require new staff. I mean, and where are these people where are these defendants that are charged with these crimes while they're awaiting trial? Are they generally in prison?
Ms. McFarland, I think you're up first on this one.
For the record, Renee McFarland, through the chair, Representative Drummond. The agency does not take a position on this litigation. Our purpose being here today is to allow the committee to understand how this legislation, if passed, will affect the work that we do, that we are constitutionally required to do. So I don't mean to suggest that we are in favor or against the litigation. We're just trying to give you the perspective that we see of how it will affect the work we do.
I think you mean the legislation, not the litigation.
Sorry, you know, a lawyer, that's where my mind goes. I apologize. As far as where individuals are, it depends. Some people are in jail and pretrial detention, awaiting trial. Other individuals are on conditions of release. It's decided in each case individually by the judge who is assigned to that case. They set conditions of release. Some individuals are able to meet those conditions and are subject to those conditions pending trial. Others are unable and they are held in custody pending trial.
Mr. Stinson, anything to add?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Klayman. Yeah, I just want to be clear. I'm not advocating for or against this legislation. I'm not taking an advocacy position. I'm simply trying to inform the committee of some of the challenges and some of the issues that might surround a change in this law. I mean, my main concern as a director of the agency is just to ensure that I provide testimony regarding the resources that the agency might require, any unintended consequences that might occur, or potential challenges. But I'm certainly not saying that this is a bad bill or a good bill. I think ultimately this is a policy call for the legislature.
And
follow-up?
I think I would absolutely support an increase in staffing in both of your offices should it be necessary, because I know your caseload is astronomical. And I also, Mr. Chairman, if I could recognize that the sponsor of the bill, Representative Tarr, is in the room, of sponsor of HB 5. And I'd also like to ask, what is the status of Senate Bill 187, and why are we discussing it in this committee?
I'll just note that at an earlier presentation in the committee, when Deputy Attorney General Skidmore was here talking about the administration's approach to consent, which has some differences from the approach to consent in House Bill 5, that approach to consent is included in Senate Bill 187. There's also a companion House bill to 187, the number which I don't know, but that's not before this committee. That's currently in a state affairs referral. So the reason that we're making reference to it is just to kind of keep connection to what we've already heard in this committee about the different approaches to consent. And the approach to consent and the affirmative definition of consent is part of what is in House Bill 5.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could ask, do you know where SB 187 is in the process in the other House?
I don't know. I do my best to know what's going on in this body, but the Senate, I sometimes know what's on their floor, but
understood. I have the same problem. Okay, I'll wait for the time being. Thank you,
Representative Vance. Did you have a follow up, and I didn't see it soon enough? Okay, Representative Snyder. Any questions, Representative Kirka, Representative Price Tompkins?
Nothing here, Mr. Chair.
I had some follow up questions about. You made reference, the Alaska's Rape Shield Law has been mentioned a couple of times. And can you describe how the Rape Shield Law works in practice today and how that may or may not change if we adopt an affirmative consent definition? And I think if I'm tracking right, Mr. Stinson, you're up first on this one. I'm trying to alternate between the two of you, so you each get a chance to go first and another chance to go second. And if I don't always remember the alternation, that's my fault and nothing else but my error. Mr. Stinson.
Thank you, Chair Klayman. Once again, James Stinson, Director, Office of Public Advocacy. So the general proposition of the Rape Shield Statute, I think it's AS 1245045, essentially says that you cannot admit the prior sexual history of a victim in a sexual assault case unless certain circumstances are met. And so there is case law where as long as the judge makes a finding that it's relevant outside of the presence of a jury, it's potentially admissible if it's about, you know, the sexual history between a victim and that particular defendant, because then it might be relevant. There still has to be a showing, and in those narrow circumstances, that might come in. The changing of it to an affirmative consent sort of framework raises an interesting question, because there are ways to bypass the Rape Shield Statute if there is another reason for the evidence to be admitted. So if, for example, the defense is, I wasn't with this person on the night in question because they were, in fact, having sexual relations with someone else on that night, well, you're not admitting that evidence to show that they were having sexual relations with somebody else, right? You're admitting that to show that you weren't there. You were admitting that as an alibi. So there are ways where you're not actually, working within the context of the Rape Shield Law. What's been raised with me, with other defense attorneys I've talked to, and what's unclear to me is whether there's an argument that the manner of consent is outside of the Rape Shield Law. As in, Your Honor, my client perceived the victim consented. The fact that my client's perception is confirmed by other individuals who are given consent in the same or substantially similar manner is relevant to whether or not my client's perception of consent was accurate. So you could argue that barring that testimony would basically preclude the defendant from putting on a defense, because the argument would be the issue is the manner of affirmative consent. It's not being admitted to bring up the victim's sexual past history. It's being admitted to show that the manner of consent was consistent with what was given to the defendant. I know in previous discussions this came up. I know John Skidmore, I think his response was that defense attorneys will certainly get creative. Department of Law would probably vehemently oppose that. And ultimately, it's up to a judge to rule. But I think that's just one open question in terms of the application of the Rape Shield statute that we can't fully answer right now.
Can you give me an example, and then I'll turn to Ms. McFarland. Can you give me an example of a factual scenario in which the Rape Shield Law today would bar prior admission of prior conduct of the victim, and with the affirmative consent, it might no longer be barred?
Sure. So, Chair Klayman, under the current law with the use of force or coercion, I don't think the prior sexual history of a victim could be relevant if it's not with the defendant. Theoretically it could, but that's the general way the Rape Shield works. It's designed to prevent somebody from, just being humiliated or having their past sexual history brought up. With the affirmative consent framework, it's about whether the victim's words or actions indicated consent. And so if the defendant has prior knowledge of how a particular person gives consent to sexual contact or sexual intercourse, and they've been consistent with that manner of consent in previous relationships, it's conceivable that there could be defense investigation that would bring that up, because then that would lend weight to the claim that the defendant's actions were affirmatively consented to. So if it's a dispute between whether or not there was affirmative consent, I think it certainly meets relevance as to whether or not a person saying a certain thing or doing a certain thing is consistent with past actions. I think it's tenuous as to whether or not a judge would admit that and under what circumstances, but it certainly raises that issue. So an example might be somebody says, somebody meets somebody at a certain place and they always say, you want to come in for a nightcap, or they do something specific, and that's consistently been the manner in which they consent. Is that relevant to whether or not there was affirmative consent? probably is that the totality of the circumstances, no, will a judge let that come in under the new statutory framework? I don't know. I'm just saying that there's the argument there that it's not about past sexual history, right? That it's about the actual mechanism for providing affirmative consent. And that's why it's relevant. And that's why it should be admissible outside the rape shield statute.
Ms. McFarland.
For the record, Renee McFarland. I would say that one way of thinking about the rape field statute is that it essentially codifies two evidence rules that apply to the evidence admitted in every single case. What Rape Shield requires is that evidence be relevant to the issue presented, and that's required under Evidence Rule 401. And it also must be more probative than prejudicial, and that's Evidence Rule 403. And the Alaska Court of Appeals, when talking about the Rape Shield statute, talks about how the test for admissibility is essentially identical to these two rules. So that's what substantively the Rape Shield statute does. It also sets up a procedure which requires a defendant seeking to admit evidence of a victim's past sexual conduct to make an application to the court before that is done. You know, with just regular evidence, you ask your question or you put your witness on, and it's up to the other side to make an objection. But under the Rape Shield statute, an application must be made beforehand so that this doesn't happen without the judge making a determination beforehand. So then the judge goes through that analysis. They're required to hold a hearing outside the presence of the jury to determine the admissibility. And then the judge determines if it is admissible, and if so, how it's admissible. When this evidence does get admitted, and presumably the same would happen under HB 5 prosecutions, the judge can put limits on how it's admitted, the scope of the evidence that is presented, how the evidence is elicited, and that is sort of how it works in practice.
So let me put a hypothetical scenario out. You've got a person who's charged with sex assault for having sex with a person on a Friday night, and the allegation is they went back to the victim's apartment from a bar and engaged in sexual conduct, and the claim is that this was without consent, and the defendants as well. I was in the same bar the Friday night before, and the same person went back with another person who I know, and I learned later that in the kind of the same circumstances they went back and had sex with a different person the Friday night before. How would that approach be applied under the current law, and how would that differ under the new law for purposes of the Rape Shield statute? And Ms. McFarland, I'll let you continue on that.
For the record, Renee McFarland to the chair. Under the current law, you know, it's a little difficult to see the relevance of this to whether the conduct was coerced through the use of force. That would be the question that the initial question the judge would need to determine: is this evidence relevant to the issues that are before the jury? And the issue before the jury under current law is, did the defendant coerce the victim to engage in the sexual conduct? You know, what somebody did with somebody else at a different time is, you know, irrelevant, at best marginally relevant to the question of whether there was coercion through the use of force. And so I think under the case law that the Court of Appeals has on this issue, they would probably determine it not relevant. I think it's probably more relevant under HB 5, but that's just the first step, right? Like, you need to make relevance, and then there's the probative versus unfair prejudice question. And there, what the judge would be doing would be looking at how probative is this. And by doing that, you'd be looking at what is at issue before the jury. And under HB 5, what they'll be looking at is whether there was freely given reversible agreement. There's the language about, sorry, looking at my wrong one here.
Um,
In Section 5 of the bill, it talks about how the lack of consent is inferred based on the circumstances, and the surrounding circumstances shall be considered. And so if the defendant were aware of this information, that may be a surrounding circumstance that a judge could determine would be more probative. And so the judge would determine that probative value and then weigh it against the risk of undue prejudice, confusion of the issues, and the invasion of privacy that it would entail. And so judges do these balancing things all the time in these cases, and the judge would make that determination. So it's hard to say whether it would be admissible in a given case, but I think it's fair to say that it would be more likely to be admissible under HB 5 than it would be under current law.
Just a short follow-up, does it change the focus from the conduct of the defendant to the conduct of the victim?
I think so, to the chair. More so, you know, what prosecutions are looking at now, like I said before, is whether the defendant coerced the victim to engage in the conduct. So, you know, what the victim did is an issue, right? Did the person submit? Did they engage? But the focus of the question is, was there coercion? That's what the state has to prove. Whereas with HB 5's affirmative consent definition, there needs to, what the state would be required to prove was that the victim did not consent. So the jury would be looking at, did the victim give affirmative consent, or was there a lack of affirmative consent? And then, if so, was the defendant reckless in disregarding that lack of consent? So I think there is more of a focus on the victim, or at least the victim and the defendant's behavior together, than is under the way the statute is written right now.
Mr. Stinson, on the same topic.
And Chair Klayman, for the record, once again, James Stinson, Director, Office of Public Advocacy. Largely echo the statements of Ms. McFarland, and I don't mean to suggest that you know, judges are going to be willy-nilly admitting you know, past sexual history because of the change in HB 5, but I do agree that it heightens the relevancy due to the focus now being on whether by words or actions somebody gave affirmative consent. I think in the hypothetical you laid out, I would still think that, you know, it'd be a question of how relevant is it. Let's assume it's relevant, highly, you know, potentially highly prejudicial, invasive, compared to the probative value. But if you add other facts, if you add other context, then you start to sort of heighten the probative value of that. And really, once you get to a point where it becomes a key part, I think, of someone's defense, and it informs whether or not they were reckless to a lack of consent, That's when I think a judge has to weigh whether or not to admit prior history. I don't know how many of those kinds of cases there will be. I'm sure there will be at least one, but that's sort of what I'm talking about.
Representative Vance, I'm trying to keep a rotation going. So Representative Vance, then Representative Collins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It sounds like the really short, and this is just for clarification, and correct me if I got this wrong, but under the current law, there has to be proof of the use of force, where under SB 5, it would be more leaning towards proof that there was reckless disregard for consent. Is that kind of a short summary?
And Mr. Stinson, you're up first on this one.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Klayman. A defendant would have to be reckless as to a lack of consent, and there would certainly, you know, be testimony surrounding whether or not there was affirmative consent or lack thereof on behalf of the victim of the case.
Ms. McFarland?
For the record, Renee McFarland, through the chair, Representative Vance, just to make a slight distinction in how you characterize current law, I would say it's not so much a use of force, it's whether the defendant coerced the victim to engage in it through the use of force. It's a slight distinction, but it's one that does make a difference, especially in second-degree sexual assault prosecutions. And so the question is, you know, was the victim compelled to submit because of force, or the threat of force, not just the force itself, if that makes sense.
All right, thank you.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that on page 5 of the bill in section 5, lines 17 and 18 seem to me to enforce the rape shield law that we currently have in place. It says a current or previous dating, social, or sexual relationship by itself, or the manner of dress of the person involved with the defendant in the conduct at issue, may not constitute consent. So I don't see how any judge could draw previous relationships of the victim into this argument.
And I think Ms. McFarland, you're up first this time.
For the record, Renee McFarland, through the chair, Representative Drummond. I think the distinction there is the language by itself. And so that would not be the only thing that would prove a lack of affirmative consent. And it may be that when a defendant seeks to admit evidence of this, the court would find that it doesn't meet the standard to be admitted under either 1245.045 or the evidence rules. But I think the way that I'm reading this language is that when you're looking at what consent is, the fact that you had a prior relationship does not mean that you consented, which that's what that says. But when you look at the same page, page 5, subsection 3 at line 28, it says the surrounding circumstances shall be considered. And I think that's where you get into the broader background, perhaps, that might make past conduct more admissible in the prosecution under this section than it would be under the current law.
And Mr. Stinson, same topic.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Klayman. So Representative Drummond, yeah, that's correct. I mean, there is a case law, like the POCA v. State, which says testimony regarding prior consensual sexual relationship between the defendant and the victim is admissible. I think what you cited
is or is not admissible. I'm sorry, did you say it is admissible or is not admissible?
Is admissible as long as the requirements of 12.45.045 are met. That's for between, so that's somebody's past relationship. It's not always admissible, but it can be admissible. It depends on the relevancy. Did they date 2 years ago? In that case, it's not going to be very relevant. Were they in a previous dating relationship leading up to this, to the incident? Then that might be more relevant and might be admissible. So I think what it's saying in the bill is just that you can't consider any one independent thing as per se evidence of consent, which is pretty well settled law. So nobody would say because you're dating someone that they can't be raped, or because you're married to somebody, they can't be raped. I think that's what that's reinforcing, or simply because somebody dresses a certain way, that's somehow a defense to sexual assault. That would be ridiculous. So it's saying that any of those things independently alone are not a defense, but within the context of a dating relationship and everything else that goes with it, looking at the totality of the circumstances, a prior dating relationship with someone is still potentially relevant, potentially admissible.
Representative Drummond, it looks like you're thinking.
I am. I'll keep thinking for a while. So go on to the next, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I'm looking at that same section 5 and looking at the part where it's talking about an expression of lack of consent. And I'm wondering, I find that language a little bit new to me. And I'm just wondering if either of our guests can offer any perspective on the use of the word expression, and if to what extent that is the same or different than the way that these prosecutions and offenses will go forward.
Mr. Stinson, you're up first on this one.
Yes, so Representative Eastman, through the chair, I take that to mean essentially what it means on it, on its face, which is even, you know, under the existing statutory framework, if somebody says no, right, if somebody says stop, and the person doesn't, then they've expressed a lack of consent through, you know, words or conduct, and there is no consent. So I think under existing law, that would fall under the force or coercion if someone didn't stop at that point, and would also similarly meet the language of HB 5 in terms of somebody obviously is not affirmatively consenting to something that they are, in fact, expressing their lack of consent to. In terms of the exact use of the word expression, I don't have much to add on that. I don't know if Ms. McFarland does.
Ms. McFarland.
For the record, Renee McFarland, to the chair, Representative Eastman. I don't think I have much to add on that. I'm not sure if the sponsor had something specific they were looking for. Otherwise, I would say I read that the plain language of that to me means that if someone says something that suggests they don't consent, that means there is no consent, and that would be something that would be relevant and probably litigated under current law, but it would not be the only thing. You would still have to show coercion through the use of force, even when there is a subjective lack of consent. There still needs to be coercion through the use of force under current law.
Representative Eastman, follow up.
Thank you. Yeah, and the reason expression, you know, is a word in statute, I guess, just seems interesting to me is it does the use of that type of language in statute, does that narrow the focus or highlight the focus on the intention of the person doing the expressing to the extent where the focus becomes, you know, I considered it an expression of consent more so than, you know, the other side of the coin would be, you know, if you're the defendant, well, I didn't consider that an expression of consent. And it seems just the way we use our language, as I'm looking at it, I'm wondering if it sort of puts more focus on the intention of the person who's doing the expression. And I'm just, do you have any thoughts or perspective on that you can offer?
I think Ms. McFarland, you're up first on this one.
For the record, Renee McFarland, through the chair, Representative Eastman. I think one way to think about this is looking at the elements. If this case were to go to a jury and you look at the jury instructions, what the state would have to prove. And one of the things the state, for the purposes of this discussion, there's two things. They would have to prove that the conduct was without consent, and that is focusing on the victim. Did the victim consent to the conduct at issue? And so this language, the expression of lack of consent through words or conduct means no consent, that goes to that element. So I think in that sense, yes, it's putting the focus on the victim there. The state would also be required to prove that the defendant recklessly disregarded the lack of consent. So just the fact that the victim didn't consent isn't sufficient. You also have to have a mental state for the defendant, and that's the reckless disregard. So you would still be looking at the defendant, but and how, whether it was reckless to disregard this conduct that the statute says means there's no consent. Was it reckless for the defendant to disregard that? And so there, you would be looking also at the defendant, but this language, I think it's fair to say it does focus on whether the victim did consent.
Mr. Stinson.
Through the chair, Representative Clayman, largely echoing what Ms. McFarland said, I mean, ultimately, a lot of these cases are going to come down to two individuals who are alone, and there's going to be some manner of debate or disagreement over whether affirmative consent was expressed or not expressed. I don't have much more to add other than that. As was already stated, you know, the defendant would have to be reckless as to the lack of consent. Ultimately, a jury is going to be the trier of fact. In the case, they're going to determine what the facts are. That's what they do. The judge determines what the law is. So as the jury establishes facts as to what someone said or didn't say, and they are convinced that something was said or not said, or they think the defendant is lying or telling the truth, I think that's going to be the interaction with whether or not consent was expressed, whether it was not expressed, and then whether, if not expressed, the defendant was reckless to not picking up on that expression of a lack of consent.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you.
Got there before I got a question ready.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of perhaps and potentially being used in this entire exchange. And I know in the world of human behavior, it's really hard to predict what's going to change that behavior. But as a non-lawyer, I think our laws need the teeth that this bill has in it. And nothing else seems to be working to reduce the worst rate of sexual assault in the United States. And I honestly believe that we should try this because nothing else seems to be working. That's my opinion.
That's more a comment than a question, I think.
Exactly.
All right. So, Mr. Stinson, I think you're up next. There's three cases that I've been referenced multiple times to look at with regard to these questions about the existing law of consent and use of force. And the three cases are the Townsend case, the Mayfield case, and the Inga case, I-N-G-A. Are you comfortable giving kind of a review of those three cases and talking about how those affect both the current law and how the analysis of those cases would change if House Bill 5 I'll broadly say just an affirmative consent law passed, became the law in Alaska.
So Chair Klayman, I certainly could. I have it in front of me, although I will say I believe Ms. McFarland was actually directly involved in those three cases. So she may be the better person to go first. I have a synopsis, but I think she actually worked on those cases.
Ms. McFarland, is that correct? Were you involved in one or more of those cases?
Two of them.
All right. Well, then I will let you go first, since I'm going to presume you have a better knowledge of the cases and the decisions and how they would impact or how they would change or not change depending on if this law passed.
For the record, Renee McFarland to the chair. I'll start with Townsend and Inga. What Townsend and Inga discuss is the distinction between sexual penetration or contact. That is achieved by force and coercion that is achieved by force. And this is a little bit of the distinction I made in response to Representative Vance's question. And so with this distinction, sexual contact or penetration that occurs through the use of force is not necessarily coerced through the use of force, which is what you need under current law to be without consent.
Can you describe the facts of those two cases? Because I think without the facts of the case, it gets pretty, as Representative Drummond was saying, it can seem fairly ambiguous. But if you can describe what was going on in both the Townsend and Inga cases, I think that would help our discussion.
Yeah, that's right where I was going with it. So in Townsend happened, what Townsend was there was an individual at a bar in Juneau and reached out as somebody was walking by and briefly grabbed the shaft of this person's penis, did not know the person, did not have any indication to believe that the man whose penis was grabbed would wanted that to happen. And he was charged with second-degree sexual assault, which required sexual contact without consent. That was the first case that sort of dealt with this distinction between force and coercion through the use of force, and his indictment was dismissed because the court found that although there was force, because there's force inherent in the touching, the conduct wasn't coerced through the use of force. And so that didn't rise to the level of second-degree sexual assault under our statute as it's currently written, looking at the entire circumstances of what happened. Several years later, the Inga case came up, and the defendant in Inga argued that he was convicted of second-degree sexual assault, and he argued that his case was like Townsend's case, and it didn't have the force required to rise to the level of second-degree sexual assault. And there, the Court of Appeals said, no, that's not the case. The facts there were quite different. The victim was isolated in a location with a man that she had good reason to be afraid of. The sexual contact in that case, which was touching the female breast, occurred immediately after the victim unequivocally refused to have sex with the defendant. And the defendant's immediate response to that was, to the victim's attempt to resist further contact, was to attack her. And there was a physical assault that occurred following that. So looking at the circumstances in their entirety there, the court found that that was sufficient to show that the sexual contact was coerced by the use of force. And so what this line of cases talks about essentially is that the force required for a sexual assault under current law must be more than the force inherent in the act itself. So just touching a female breast or genitalia is not enough. There needs to be something that coerces, some force that coerces that contact. Mayfield came several years later, and it considered how this Townsend and Finga line of cases applied to attempted second-degree sexual assault. And essentially what the court found there, so that involved a man in a movie theater who changed seats to sit closer to a 14-year-old girl. He started to put his hands, his fingertips down her pants. She believed he was going to touch her buttocks. She yelled at him, he withdrew his hand, and she left. So there was no sexual contact at all. And the question for the trial court in that case, which is also a dismissal of an indictment, was whether there was sufficient evidence that he intended to touch without consent under that current law definition. And what the court said is that the intent required for these attempts must be an intent to use force if necessary. And the court found that looking at all the circumstances in that case, both the evidence relating to the intent to use force and the intent to engage in sexual contact, that there was not enough to uphold the indictment. Mayfield, however, did plead guilty to an offense. He pled guilty to harassment, so that's what he ended up being charged with. I'd say, you know, this line of cases, it gets pretty in the weeds of our sexual assault definition, but I think how HB 5 would change that is a little more straightforward, because it would change the analysis, I think, and how we look at these cases. Because we're not asking anymore whether the defendant coerced the contact through use of force. The question of whether the force was inherent in the touch or coercive is not really the issue. We're looking at whether the defendant recklessly disregarded the lack of consent or intended to disregard that lack of consent. So for Townsend and Mayfield, they were both cases in which the defendant didn't go to trial. The charges were dismissed before trial because the court found that the indictment didn't charge an offense. I think under HB 5, you would survive a motion to the state would survive a motion to dismiss the indictment. If those cases would go to trial. I think whether a jury would convict those cases, that goes back to the question that we don't know what's going to happen. It all depends on what happens in an individual case. But I think it would change the analysis on these pretrial motions to dismiss.
Mr. Stinson, anything to add?
I think that's a good synopsis. The only thing I'll add, Chair Klayman, is that part of I think the court's discussion, certainly in Mayfield and Townsend, is sort of this distinction between what is harassment versus sexual assault, and sort of sussing that out. And I know one of the things that the court in Townsend said is that this may in fact be a harassment. We're just saying it's not a sexual assault. And so in terms of a policy call, how the legislature chooses to distinguish between those categories of crimes is up to you all. I will say that, Inga was a pretty egregious case. I don't know of any statutory framework that he wouldn't have been convicted under on that one. Obviously, Mayfield gets more borderline because it calls into question what you need to prove an attempt, because there wasn't a completed crime there. And I think Ms. McFarland's correct that it would probably survive a probable cause finding. I think the question is whether or not he still would have taken a substantial step toward the completion of that crime under those facts. And I think that's a question that a jury would have to suss out.
Slightly different angle, Mr. Topic, Mr. Stinson. Ms. McFarland testified about the public defender's preliminary fiscal note, I think, on Senate Bill 187. Did the Office of Public Advocacy submit any kind of fiscal note relating to 187? And if so, or for that matter, if you submitted anything on House Bill 5, could you talk about what fiscal notes you may or may not have added?
Yes, certainly, Chair Klayman. OPIS is actually larger than the PDAs or the Department of Laws. I can give my reason for that. I submitted a draft version for 187. I would anticipate a similar submission for HB 5 as it progresses. I think one of the reasons we held off on indeterminate fiscal notes is we weren't certain how the bills would all change and progress. So rather than having to make multiple fiscal notes, I think we were waiting on this one for a little bit. With this particular fiscal note, I was asking for 6 PCNs. Only one was an attorney PCN, an attorney 5 that I would have predominantly handle these sex assault cases, and then asking for 2 defense investigators and 3 law office assistant 2s. However, the total fiscal note that I have is approximately 2.5 million, more like 2.6. The reason being is my request is to increase the contract line by 30%. There's several reasons for that. One reason is, you know, OPA is broken up into multiple independent law firms that are small. Our lease spaces are running out of room. I don't have much room to expand. One idea was, do I try to get a new lease space and create a dedicated sex crimes unit? But that runs into the problem of we're essentially having to compete with the public defender agency for an ever-increasing smaller pool of attorneys. Last year, I know Department of Law got, I believe, over 10 PCNs. I know the PDA got some. OPA did not receive any new PCNs. So we're sort of behind the curve already. I think I came to the conclusion that our contract, our hourly contract rate for independent contractors is so out of date that this must just be the time to update that. And so 1.89 million of that is to try to increase the contract line 30%, which is consistent with previous testimony on the admin subcommittee, where we increased the case caps for our contractors by 30%, but we haven't had the ability to increase the hourly rate of compensation. That's the best option I can come up with. Obviously, these are not easy cases to defend. They're not easy cases to prosecute. You don't want to burn out your in-house attorneys and cause more attrition by just overloading them with these types of cases. Contractors typically don't want to take them. There are very few contractors willing to take very few sexual assault cases. So I think the only solution I could come up with is to increase the out-of-date contract line so that we can incentivize contracting out a fair amount of these cases. Another tactic I might do is try to contract out more homicides and then try to keep more of these sex cases in-house. But in either scenario, I think we're going to have significant contract expenditures.
Is your expectation that you'd have more of these cases would be handled by outside contractors through the through your agency, or more would be handled by in-house lawyers?
So, Chair Klayman, it's going to be a split. The reason I'm asking just for that attorney 5 as the only attorney is because I do think it's sensible to have at least one person in-house that can specialize in this and basically make that what they do. Hard to find people to hire for that. I imagine it's going to be a split, especially because we can't predict what jurisdictions these are going to come from. If there are more cases being charged in areas like, you know, Nome, Kotzebue, other rural areas, they can have high conflict rates. And so it may be the case that more of those need to go to independent contractors as opposed to cases being charged more in Anchorage. It may be the case that they're easier to keep in-house. But I certainly anticipate having to pay contractors more to take these cases, and just with the backlog, and that's already in existence. I just don't see another option other than finally increasing the contract line rather than expanding multiple leases for multiple small law offices, all the startup costs that go with that, and then trying to hire in-house attorneys when there's very few in-house attorneys to hire.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Simpson, so it looks like once the fiscal notes are written, it would express your need for additional resources, and should this bill pass, you will get those resources. Am I correct?
through the chair, Representative, I certainly hope so. I think that's up to you all. But that would certainly be my hope. I think that that is a reasonable estimate as to what we would need to operate, to continue to meet our statutory and constitutionally obligated duties.
Ms. McFarland, anything to add on that one?
No, thank you.
I next want to turn to, unless I don't see other questions, I wanted to also turn to the change in the law with regard to sexual abuse of a minor, that the provisions include a conduct that today is not a crime would become a crime. How do you expect that to impact your agencies and also how trials are processed? And I think Ms. McFarland, you're up first on this one.
For the record, Renee McFarland to the chair. The proposed changes in the bill to the SAM statutes, like you said, they criminalize conduct that right now is legal under law, specifically as to individuals who are 16 and 17, the age of consent in Alaska when there is not a relationship where there's a position of authority is 16. And so under HB 5, individuals who are 16 and 17 and engaged in sexual conduct with somebody who is 10 years older, that would become illegal. So that's new conduct that is not currently criminal under law. And it, for those who are between 13 and 15 and 10 years younger, it increases the level of offense. So what that means is that you are having new conduct that for sexual penetration is first degree sexual abuse of a minor, and for conduct that is currently illegal at second degree sexual abuse of a minor, it becomes first degree sexual abuse of a minor. The substance of the litigation probably won't change too much. You know, ages usually aren't all that much in dispute. The evidence can be pretty straightforward on those, but the consequences for those convictions are different, and that just changes the seriousness of the offense, which requires more work as you go through the case. So raising the presumptive term for a first felony offender convicted of second degree sexual abuse of a minor is 5 to 15 years, and raising it to first degree sexual abuse of a minor, it raises that presumptive term to 20 to 30 years. So there's a really significant increase in the minimum presumptive term somebody could be facing, which increases the seriousness. That's for cases where the conduct at issue is sexual penetration. For sexual contact, it's a little more complicated because as I read HB 5, they raise, so right now sexual contact is third degree sexual abuse of a minor, and it's a sexual felony punished under those sentencing statutes if there's a 6-year age difference. So the bill does the same thing for sexual contact that it does for sexual penetration with the 10-year difference, but it doesn't have conforming language like it does for the sexual penetration language. And so it's a little uncertain to me, but the difference we're looking at there would be a range of 2 to 12 years under current law to 5 to 15 years. So it's not as dramatic, but especially with the first degree sexual assault, sexual abuse of a minor prosecutions, that increased minimum sentence does increase consequences somebody faces, which increases the complexity of the case for our lawyers.
Mr. Stinson, anything to add on that?
Chair Klayman, for the record, James Stinson, Director, Office of Public Advocacy. Just that this is going to be conduct that previously wasn't criminal that's being criminalized now, so obviously there's going to be some increase in caseload. As to what that is, I don't know. I don't know how many people that are at least 10 years older than a 16 or 17-year-old who are dating them are going to be prosecuted under this. To the extent they are, I agree with Ms. McFarland's assessment that obviously the stakes are going to be pretty high due to the penalties involved.
Do either of you know how long the age of consent has been 16 in Alaska? This is a history question.
Renee McFarland. It definitely predates the 1978 revision to the criminal statutes. The statutes in effect before that had it wasn't sexual abuse of a minor or sexual assault. It was a rape statute, and it criminalized sexual penetration with somebody who was younger than 16. And I haven't gone back to look. My guess is that that statute was enacted at or around the time of statehood, so a long time, but I can't give you specifics.
Okay. And topic that's come up more recently here in the House because of other legislation, child marriage, and what is the impact of the current child marriage provisions on the sex abuse of a minor changes that are proposed in this bill? I'll give Mr. Stinson the first shot on this one because Ms. McFarland answered the last one first.
Thank you, Chair Klayman. I believe that would depend on the effective date. Moving forward, I think that would be an issue right now. Ms. McFarland can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that marriage is a defense under these circumstances as long as it's a consensual relationship, right? So that if somebody is married, even if there's that age gap, right, if it's a legal marriage in front of a judge and everything else, I believe that that's a defense to consensual sex within the context of that relationship. Moving forward, since those marriages would presumably be illegal, it wouldn't happen. But I can try to look that up. I see Ms. McFarland trying to look that up. But that was my understanding.
Ms. McFarland?
I was just looking for the statute number. For the record, Renee McFarland. The statute is 1141-445. And so that makes it an affirmative defense that the victim was a legal spouse of the victim at the time the conduct occurred, unless the offense was committed without the consent. So that means unless there was that coercion through the use of force, the marriage relationship means you haven't committed sexual abuse of a minor. So changes to eligibility of marriage ages will change who can partake of that defense. But as to what that does more broadly to all of this, I have no idea how that would affect the rates of these things.
So I earlier said that I was going to likely get a note that I need to go to another committee to present a bill. So we're going to have to recess to the call of the chair. I know Representative Snyder had her hand up. And so we're going to, when we come back, if we get back before 3, we'll get to Representative Snyder. Obviously, we won't continue past 3, but we're going to recess to the call of the chair. And we'll try to get you notice as soon as possible if I get out of the other committee before 3 o'clock.
Mr. Chair, my question was answered. Thank you.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, then we won't go you first. We're going to recess to the call of the chair. And appreciate the patience of members of the committee and everybody here that's watching. Query, is there any, Representative Kirka, you have your yellow hand up on Teams. Did you have a question?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I did. If Ms. McFarland or Mr. Stinson are still available.
They appear to be, and you'll get an answer from both of them, as has been the practice today.
Okay, well, I appreciate the discussion. I think it's been very informative and helpful. I guess my question has to do with, I think that hasn't been asked yet, is regarding the current working draft of HB 5 has certain definitions of consent and rape by fraud and incapacitation language. The Department of Law, when Assistant Attorney General John Skidmore came before us, presented some alternative language and had raised some concern with the language of the bill. And I wanted to know if Ms. McFarland or Mr. Stinson had looked at that and their thoughts on that, and if they could, I guess, give their thoughts on the competing language, if you will.
So comparing the language that's in Senate Bill 1, 87 and in this bill. I think I'll give.
Mr. Chairman, was the department, the handout that the department law gave us when Mr. Skidmore came before us, was that the from the 187?
That's my understanding is that what's in Senate Bill 187 is the same language that he handed out, or to the extent it wasn't in 187, they were going to ask that it be amended in and made part of it.
Okay.
That's how I understood Mr. Skidmore's testimony. So, Ms. McFarland, I'll give you the first shot on the comparison between the two.
For the record, Renee McFarland, through the chair, Representative Kirka, I don't have the language that Mr. Skidmore presented to the committee in front of me. And I think, and I'm not 100% sure on this, is that the language that the Senate Judiciary Committee ultimately adopted in SB 187 might be slightly different. There might have been some amendments from what law was proposing. So I can speak generally to the differences between HB 5 and SB 187, but that might be slightly different than the language that you represented by Mr. Skidmore.
Do the best you can with what you have.
Right. So they are similar, but there are some distinctions. I'd say that probably the definition of consent in HB 5 at page 6, line 1, the version in SB 187 is relatively similar. What the difference, the most significant difference is it doesn't have the language beginning on line 3 about the what freely given means. There's not that extra language defining freely given. It just says under the totality of the circumstances, there is not a freely given reversible agreement. And then section 5 of HB 5 on page 5 starting at 11, there's similar language in SB 187 to that, but again, there are some distinctions. One of the primary distinctions is that SB 187 doesn't have the language at line 15 through 17 about the use of force, and that is because SB 187 creates a separate offense with the use of force and has affirmative consent as a different one. One of the other distinctions is that it does not include the manner of dress language, and I know that was a point of discussion in Senate Judiciary. I don't know the details of that discussion, however. SB 187 does not have the language in subsection 2 about consenting to force or consenting to being rendered unconscious. So that means that, you know, as just looking at the plain language of the two bills, SB 187 would potentially allow somebody to consent to conduct that is likely to cause injury or to cause somebody to be unconscious, whereas that would be illegal under HB 5. The professional purpose, the fraudulent professional purpose, is similar between the two bills. And then HB 5 has subsection 3, which is not included in SB 187. And so what I would say is that they take similar but slightly distinct approaches to the question, and how those distinctions would affect convictions would really depend on a case-by-case determination of the particular facts of a case as to whether those distinctions would impact the prosecution.
Mr. Stinson.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Clayman. I think Ms. McFarland did a really good job summarizing. Just to restate, I think the biggest difference is SB 187 maintains more of the existing framework by reserving sexual assault 1 for still when there's the use of force or the express or implied threat of force being used. That's the higher tier. That's the unclassified. Whereas sexual assault just without consent is the second tier, is an A felony. So I think the difference is in the bills, and under HB 5, it'd be the 20 to 30 year presumptive active time on a first offense. And under SB 187, for conduct that is just without consent, think it would be 5 to 15 years would be the presumptive range, if I'm not mistaken. So that's the main difference. But as Ms. McFarland said, they do seem to be substantially similar in a lot of ways. I also know SB 187 has a separate section that does say that sexual assault one includes situations where an offender makes a person become incapacitated prior to sexual penetration. But I guess Ms. McFarland is correct in that there's nothing explicitly stating that you cannot consent to being made incapacitated. So that might be something they need to clean up, but they certainly have conduct where a defendant is making someone become incapacitated, criminalized.
All right, Representative Kirk, any follow-up?
No, I'm good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And Representative Drummond, any additional questions?
Or yeah, other than I'm just being confused by SB 187, which hasn't even made it out of the other body yet. It's just not, it's not helping me in my in my thinking about HB 5.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, I don't see any other questions, so we're going to hold the bill for further review, and we're going to adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is scheduled for Friday, April 1st at 1 p.m. I fully plan to be having teams available, and anyone who wants to can attend by teams, and I'm encouraging folks to if you're going to be in the committee room, to wear a mask, but if you don't want to wear a mask, then appear on teams. We will not be moving. It'll be the first hearing on the bill, so the bill won't get moved on Friday, and with that, we are going to adjourn. The time is now 3:05 p.m.,
Chairman,
sorry.
Before you adjourn?
No.
I'm just curious, when are you planning to take up HB 5 again?
I don't know.
Okay.
We're adjourned.